Now, I was having this conversation with Mr. Hancock, and I thought I would also continue on with the sermon. Because really, Satan has trashed us. Satan has trashed us in many, many ways. He's trashed us individually. Individually, we've been deceived by in many ways. In our homes, we are being trashed. If you look at the kind of material that's coming out as far as personal relationships between husbands and wives and between, you know, what's this new term that they've got? Not heterophobia, is it heterophobia? Mm-hmm. Yes, it is, heterophobia, which means that basically you do not like people who are living together of opposite sex. You know, you have this homophobia, which you don't like homosexuality, but this is, you don't like people. It's not talking about marriage. It's totally different. But we are being trashed in our homes. We've been trashed in the church. In the church, Satan has trashed us in many, many areas. And in the world at large as well, the world is being trashed. But one area that is as great as anything, I think, in this modern world that has been trashed, that we all have a warped view, and I mean every single one of us in this room has a warped view because of the world that we actually live in, is the area of finances. And I don't know whether we can actually have a correct view in this modern age. You know, the financial system, the adverts that are on TV or the billboards or whatever else that we happen to see. I want to talk today about God's financial perspective. God's financial perspective. That's really what I'm talking about today. And also what I want to talk about is holding on to God's financial perspective in today's world, in today's society. Because, it's almost impossible for us to do so. It's almost impossible. It is the way of give. It's the way of give, going outward from ourselves, allowing God to bless us. And in our materialistic and godless and self-centered society, all around us, particularly in the advertising profession and everything else, we find this way of getting the raw. And I'm not just thinking about here in the UK, I'm thinking also down in Nigeria if there are people logged in. This way of get also is down there. It's in every single society. I don't care where you go. The basic way, we have been trashed within the world in this area of finances, accumulation of wealth, of getting more. That's basically what it's all about. We all want to get more. In this area. And I've got 6 points, which I think I should be able to get through all right today in the 6 hours I've got available. But according to Mr. Henderson, that is, anyway. But these 6 points, the first one I've got is that God's overall financial perspective. What's his overall financial perspective? How does God look at this world? How does God look at our place within it on a financial, on an economic basis? Secondly, I want to talk about debt and the sabbatical year. And I want to end this, in all of this, I want to show you the judgments that Mr. Armstrong made. Because the judgments that he made reflect the way, reflect the perspective of God in so many areas. And certainly in the sabbatical year, which I'll talk a little bit about, I want to show you the perspective of Mr. Armstrong in that subject. Thirdly, I want to talk about inheritance and the Jubilee. Because that is one of God's laws. It's a law that we can learn from. It's a law that we can, you know, we can go to and we can and see what, in fact, God's mind is on the subject. Fourthly, I want to talk about God's work and tithing, not just the work today. I'm thinking back into the Levitical priesthood, how it was changed, what it was changed to, what is our responsibility in that area. Fifthly, I want to talk about God's planning, and it was covered in the budgeting side. In fact, really second tithe, so God's planning and second tithe, because that gives us the principle of budgeting. That, in fact, teaches us that. And finally, I want to talk about basically loving our neighbor and third tithe, and how third tithe fits in, how third tithe, again, showing the principle Mr. Armstrong used, and how, in fact, he applied God's financial perspective in applying the principles. Okay, let's have a look at God's overall perspective his overall perspective in this area. Turn over to Psalm 50. Psalm 50. And if we're approaching this subject or any subject, we've got to get God's perspective on it and then proceed through the subject. But over in Psalm 50, we can see to a large degree God's perspective on the subject. He says, it says, the mighty God, verse 1, even the Eternal has spoken and called the earth from the rising of the sun to the going down. Out of Zion, the perfection of beauty, God has shined. Our God shall come and shall not keep silence. A fire will devour it before him, and it will be very tempestuous around him. Now we're looking at a future fulfillment. These words are not then. These are looking at the return of Christ, the establishment of his kingdom. That's what we're looking at. He shall call the heavens from above and the earth, that he may judge his people. Gather my saints together to me. That's our position. That's what we're going to be doing. Those that have made a covenant with me by sacrifice, and all of us have sacrificed to one degree or another. And the heavens shall declare his righteousness, for God is judge himself. Christ will be ruling on the earth. Selah, think about this. Get your mind into the very future. Hear my people, and I'll speak, O Israel, and I'll testify against you, and I am God, even your God. I'll not reprove you for your sacrifices or your burnt offerings to have been continually before me. So he's talking now to Israel, and the perspective is in the future. Israel that will be a physical nation in the future. I'll take no bullock out of your house or he-goats from your folds, for every beast of the forest is mine. And the cattle upon 1,000 hills. God owns the lot. You just work out how much is a cattle? What's the bullock's price these days? £400-£500, something like that. Say £500 for a bullock. How many cattle can you get on 1,000 hills? A lot. So you're looking in the mega millions in this particular passage. I know all the fowls of the mountain, and the wild beasts of the field are mine. If I were hungry, I wouldn't tell you, for the world is mine and the fullness of it. And he goes down, it says, offer to God, verse 14, offer to God thanksgiving. Pay your vows to the Most High, and call upon me in the day of trouble, and I will deliver you, and you shall glorify me. Now this is God's perspective. He looks down on this earth, I say down on this earth, however he perceives this earth, because he can perceive it in a way that we can't really understand. But he knows that the whole earth is his. Every single stick, everything is his. If he wants something, he doesn't have to come to us for it. He owns the lot. And this is the perspective that we need when we're approaching this subject. God's overall perspective is that he owns everything anyway, and his focus is the plan, is what he's doing. He's focusing on the plan, he's looking forward into the future, and he's saying, offer to God thanksgiving, pay your vows to the Most High. In other words, get our lives in order, and he'll then have this relationship with his being, and then we will be one of these individuals that he talks about gathering his people and judging the world. We turn over to Psalm 103. We find in Psalm 103 also a perspective that God has on ourselves. And we need to make sure that we do look at ourselves to some degree the way this perspective looks on us. Every single one of us in this room. Because Psalm 103 verse 13, it says, like a father, Psalm 103 verse 13, like a father pities his children, so the Eternal pities those that fear him. For he knows our frame, he remembers that we are dust. As for man, his days are as grass, as a flower of the field he flourishes. For the wind passes over it, and it's gone. And the place thereof that it should be known no more. But the mercy of the Eternal is from everlasting to everlasting upon those that fear him. And his righteousness, it says, unto the children's children, to keep as to such as keep his covenant, and to those that remember his commandments to do them. So if we are in harmony with God, if we are in fact, you know, having this relationship with God. It is the mercy of the Eternal from everlasting to everlasting on those that fear him. But he recognizes that, look, we're going to be making mistakes. He's like a father pitying his children. And all of us do make mistakes in this area. All of us have a certain perspective that isn't necessarily correct. As I said, I don't think there's any single individual in this room anywhere that has a correct perspective on this subject. We have been trashed by Satan. Satan has done an incredible job in this world and in this society so that we can't really understand what it is that we'll be going forward to into the future. Because when we're looking at the future, we're looking at a world that'll be very different. Incredibly, we won't have HSBC. It won't be there. Okay, HSBC, NatWest, all these other banks will not be there. They certainly will not be banks of the present type. They just won't be there. Because the present type is based on usury. That's how a bank makes its money. I mean, that's how a bank makes its money. And that principle is not totally wrong. It's not totally wrong. If you read what it says in the Old Testament, you're actually looking at the way that the Commonwealth of Israel will have no usury allowed, but outside the Commonwealth, you are allowed usury. I'm not going to go into that today. That's always economics. I'm thinking I'll probably deal with that in the feast sermon sometime, but that's a different subject. What I want to look at is God's financial perspective. So when we see man's life here, and we see what it says here in Psalm 103, we can see really what's the value of the wealth and the money and the effort and the work and the everything else that we go through. The value in God's eyes is righteousness. It's how we handle it. What do we do with it? That's important. Not how much we've got. It's how we handle it, which is important to him. If you turn over to Ephesians 4, I think I have time to quote this one. Go over to Ephesians 4. There's a very interesting scripture here, which I've quoted a number of times. But it says in verse 28, it says, "Let him that stole steal no more, but rather let him labor, working with his hands the thing which is good, that he may have something to give to him that needs." The purpose of actually working, the purpose of accumulating wealth, is not to sit there and see this wonderful wealth that we've got. It's so that we then have something to give. That we have the ability and the financial means and resources to be outgoing, to be like God, because God is a great blesser and he blesses in that way with wealth. And so we are like God if we have an ability to give. And this, and I want to stress this, because I'm talking to Africa as well, and I know down there that you don't have the type of wealth that we have over here. But you in Africa, every single one of you has something. And you also need to make sure that this principle still applies. It still applies to every single individual, every child should be able to go out and work so they have something and be taught then to be able to give, to be able to use that money wisely. It doesn't mean to say give it all away. That's not the point. That is not what God expects. But we do, that we become like our Father. This is the godly perspective. This is the overall perspective that we're looking at. Now, you don't get that in this world. The world just simply isn't like that. You can't find that in this world. This world has been trashed. And yet, you know, years ago, you would find community. You would find a community coming together in haymaking and helping one another and you're cooperating together. But you do not get that today because this world has been trashed. And we've got to understand that. We've got to realize that. If we turn over to Luke chapter 6, under this basic section, which is his overall perspective in Luke chapter 6, you find a verse here. I'm not going to go and read the surrounding verses, just this one verse in verse 38, Luke 6:38. "Give, and it shall be given to you. Good measure, pressed down, shaken together, running over, shall men give... Notice what it does say here. It says, shall men give into your, give to your bosom, for with the same measure that you use, it'll be used to you again. Now that is a godly principle. It's a principle that we can use. So we go out, we work, so we may have something to give, and in giving, that will more than come back on us. That is a godly principle. It's the way it is. To give you an idea of what I'm talking about God's overall perspective on this financial basis, I don't know how many of you have ever kept animals. I mean, I know Mr. Edmonds keeps animals, but the first animal we really kept was a goat. Now, I don't recommend keeping goats. At least trying to keep them in is a problem. But this goat we christened Marigold, and this particular goat was a Toggenburg. It was kind of brown with a white face, kind of a whitish stripe on the face. I knew she was a good bloodline, and I fed her well. I read the books. I read how to actually feed a goat. And you give to the goat. You try and feed. You feed her up after when she's about ready to kid, and she finally kidded. And that animal gave 1.5 gallons of milk a day. 1.5 gallons a day from one goat. That is the kind of abundance that you can have. Now, she was an exceptional milker. But if I had not fed her, if I had not given to her, it would not have come back to me. You see, built into the nature, into the creation, God has built this principle. Satan has trashed us because he's diverted us and put us against Tesco instead of having to go out to Marigold in the morning. We go down to Tesco and pull it off the shelf. Judy was in the greenhouse. We have a kind of a tunnel greenhouse, and she was going picking French beans. And she said, really, we have been trashed, because to go out there and pick something where you've grown it and you've seen it develop, and you pick it, you then are grateful to God, because it's come from a process that you actually see. It's like the flowers in front of me here. They are natural, and they are beautiful, absolutely beautiful. And you look at even just the vegetables growing, they are beautiful, and they are natural processes, and we have been trashed. The other kind of thing that you look at, the way, in fact, you look after plants. Again, this give and it'll be given to you principle within the very natural creation itself. You get something like, say, a bean or a pea or that type of, French beans for that matter, or runner beans or even broad beans or anything. The thing that they like is that they have a taproot that goes down. So what you do is you dig a trench and you put manure, rotted material down the bottom of the trench, fill the trench over, then draw a low amount out on the top and plant your beans and cover them up. And they then go down, the taproot goes down, and you produce abundantly. Now, if you do the same with carrots, you don't get the same result. You've got to think of the very, the plant itself. The carrots, you don't put manure down there, you leave it for a year so that it doesn't fork. If you're dealing with something like melons or cucumbers or marrows or pumpkins, you try and fluff the soil and the manure up so you get plenty of root run. So that each plant is in a certain type. You're trying to give to that particular plant. And I know with pumpkins, I mean, we had a half a dozen pumpkin plants. And I planted them in a row about 15 feet long. And on a mound, fluffing the manure up with the soil, which is the way you do it. Now, and that was just a few months ago, now they've covered that entire area almost to the wall. One mass of leaves. Absolute mass, and there's pumpkins all over the place. Only about this big at the moment, but they will grow. So if you don't like pumpkin pie, it's not what we're going to do with them all, I'm not quite sure, but... It was again Jacob. He came round and we got him to go ahead and plant them. And he comes every time he comes out, he runs into the garden and see how the pumpkin's getting. He kind of gets his machete out and goes through this pumpkin patch. But it produces an abundance. Two cucumber plants will feed a family with cucumbers. I mean, we're getting, what, 2 cucumbers a day? A week, something like that, from the 2 plants that we've got. And there is an abundance. I put some onion in to go to seed. And my rough calculation is from one onion, you get between 2 and 3,000 seeds. Just my rough idea of what you get from one onion that I've saved. And with seed, I mean, that's looking at the flowers, it's counting your chickens before they hatch, but there's the flowers that are on there at the moment. I know, talking about the goat, we actually went on to milk some cows, and we were literally pouring milk away. You can't keep one cow because they run off by them, you know, they go away. You can tether a goat, it's difficult to tether a cow, so you keep two. And, you know, you get 2 great pails of it and feed a calves on them. So there's 2 pails of milk per day. We were making 1 pound of butter a day from the 2 cows. And we cooked in butter, we ate butter, we gave butter away, we did, you know, that's what happens. It is an abundance. And within the natural world, within God's creation, that is the perspective of God. It is not stingy. It is something which is abundance. It comes back to you in an abundant way. But you've got to think. You've got to give in a certain way. You think about the plant that you're planting. You think about its root structure. And you try and cater for that particular plant. So this scripture that says, given, it will be given to you, that even comes out within the very principles that you learn from the natural world. Now that's God's overall perspective. And if we go through this subject and we look at the individual laws, what you're looking at is you're looking at the mind of God that then says, right, in a certain circumstance, here is what we will do. Here are the individual coded part, in other words, the laws that he actually lays down, in which we can then express this way. That's what it's all about. Now that's the spiritual heritage that we've got from Mr. Armstrong as well. He has made certain rules, you know, he's gone ahead and given certain, laid down things like makeup, for instance. He expresses his perspective of a certain topic. And it's coming from the perspective, the actual perspective of God. In other words, he's trying to reflect what he sees as God's perspective. And he does the same in financial areas as well. Let's have a look at this question of debt and the sabbatical year. Now, if we turn over to Leviticus 25, where you'll find the sabbatical year mentioned, there were people, I remember back in college, who looked at this particular scripture in Leviticus 25, and they disagreed vehemently with Mr. Armstrong, vehemently with him, because they did not have God's financial perspective. They didn't have God's perspective on the subject, and they disagreed. The ones I'm thinking of particularly were actually in the agricultural department, which is where my wife used to work. But their entire lives were involved with the agricultural side. And they had researched the sabbatical year, and they said, right, if the sabbatical year occurs, and you have animals in there, and you have droppings and all the rest of it, and how the fields regenerate, all of this had been looked at, and they therefore wanted to make sure that they had it all nailed down. But they missed the breadth that was within Scripture. They looked at Leviticus 25, and it says, verse 1, so speak to the children, verse 2, speak to the children of Israel, say to them, when you come into the land which I give you, then shall the land keep a Sabbath to the eternal. 6 years you will sow your field, 6 years you will prune your vineyard and gather in the fruit thereof, but the 7th year will be a Sabbath of rest to the land, a Sabbath for the eternal. You shall neither sow your field nor prune your vineyard. That which grows of its own accord of the harvest you shall not reap, neither gather of the grapes of your vine undressed. It's a year of rest unto the land, and the Sabbath of the land shall be food for you. In other words, you can go out into the field or into the garden and just harvest what you need and eat it. You eat it straight away. For you and your servant, your slave, and for your maid and your hired servant, your stranger that sojourns with you, and your cattle and the beasts of the land, or all the increase there will be for food. Now, the difficulty is that people did look at this verse, and in our haste to apply every word, this verse was actually applied. Ministers went in the 50s and they recommended that people go ahead and do this. When they went into talking to farmers, this was the thing to do. You've got to rest it on the seventh year. So you calculate it from your baptism or from when you learned about it, and you go and you rest it. And farmers went bankrupt. Farmers went bankrupt in the church. Because we've seen, your example about putting the money into the offering basket. When you first come into the church, you do things which are not necessarily wise. And even within the church, even the advice being given in the early days was not always wise. And Mr. Armstrong made a ruling on this. And he said, look, there is a problem with this. People are going bankrupt. That is not the way it is. You see, if we're going to go out and administer galaxies, if we are going to go out eventually to other worlds, you and I are going to have to understand godly principles. We're going to have to apply those principles in those worlds. What do you do if there's two suns and no moon or whatever on a planet? How are you going to go ahead and organize it? The principles are going to have to apply. Now, if that in fact is the case. What in fact came out was, it says an individual, this was in the entire the letter that was sent out. An individual cannot observe all the details of these laws, since that would require national legislation. Now people said, oh, it doesn't matter, you've got to apply what God says. An individual cannot release his own debts. And this is the key. You see, the sabbatical year is not just resting the land. It's a law about debt. If we go over to Exodus 23, in Exodus 23, you find, notice in verse 9, it says, also, you shall not oppress a stranger, for you know the heart of a stranger, seeing you are strangers in the land of Egypt. I want you to notice the context now of this section. 6 years you'll sow your land, and I shall gather the fruits thereof, but the seventh year let it rest and lie still, that the poor of your people may eat, and what they leave the beasts of the field will eat, and in like manner you shall deal with your vineyard and with your olive yard. Now the sabbatical year was to do with the poor. It was not just a case of less resting your land. Resting your land was one aspect, but the poor eating. And as we'll go on to see, it is not just eating the produce of that land. It is eating generally, because as we go on and we examine the sabbatical year, we'll find that in fact it's to do with debt release. 6 days shall you do your work, and then it goes into the Sabbath about resting. If we go over to Deuteronomy 15, in Deuteronomy chapter 15, we find the other part of the sabbatical year. And as I said, when Mr. Armstrong made the ruling that he did, he said, a farmer who owes money to banks probably cannot let all his land rest every 7 years, since he owes mortgage and other loan payments that must be made each year. In such a case, it's suggested that the land is rested in rotation so that each field receives its rest sometime during a 7 year period. If one is able to rest the whole farm at once, so much the better. But that was the ruling that came from Mr. Armstrong. And people in the agricultural department didn't like it. They felt it was watering down the law. But the reason why he did it is that in chapter 15, it says in verse 1, it says, the end of every 7 years, you shall make a release. Not just a rest of the land, it's a release. It is the poor of the land that the poor may eat. This is all bound up with this subject. And this is the manner of the release. Every creditor that lends anything to his neighbor will release it. He will not exact it of his neighbor or of his brother, because it's called the Lord, the Eternal's, release. Of a foreigner you may exact it again, but that which is yours with your brother you shall release. Now, this gives you the two-tier. As I said, you actually look at usury, and you look even in the sabbatical year, you've got this two-tier system. The ones within the Commonwealth of Israel will have this year of release, but it doesn't apply to people which will be outside the Commonwealth of Israel. It's an economic subject. I'm not going to go into that to any great degree today. I want to concentrate on God's financial perspective much more on a more individual basis. But I want you to notice the next verse. And if you look in the margin, what mine says in the margin, it is to the end that there will be no poor among you. That's the purpose of a sabbatical year. Now, it does not mean that you go ahead, you keep your sabbatical year, you rest your land, and then you go bankrupt. It's against the very principle that God laid down. Because it's designed to the end that you'll be no poor among you, for the Eternal will greatly bless you in the land which the Eternal your God gives you for an inheritance to possess it. And that's the very purpose, and that's the reason why Mr. Armstrong made the ruling that he did. He made the ruling looking at God's perspective, his overall perspective. He put together the different scriptures to understand what God's perspective was, and was able to make the ruling that therefore allowed farming to continue in a modern setting. Now, I can guarantee you, when we get into the millennium, which is, you know, hopefully not too far away, we will have the full sabbatical year. The sabbatical year will be in force. And we will keep it, and we'll understand it in its full, because, again, it will be a case of a release. Every 7 years, you got a debt, you get rid of it. It says in verse 7, if there among you a poor man of one of your brethren within any of your gates of the land which the Eternal gives you, you will not harden your heart or shut your hand from your poor brother, but you will open your hand wide to him and shall lend him sufficient for his need in that which he wants. Beware that there's not a thought in your wicked heart saying the seventh year of release is at hand and your eye be evil against your poor brother. Could you imagine a bank doing that today? is a bank going to be able to make any money like that? It's just not going to work. But that is God's financial perspective. It's totally different from anything that we've got in today's society. Utterly different. And yet, this subject is one that Mr. Armstrong looked at and tried to take the principle and apply it in today's world. And we should apply it in today's world. You know, where we can, we should in fact rest it on a yearly basis. Oh, not a yearly basis, on a 7 year rotation. And you rest it on that seventh year. But if that is going to cause economic hardship, then we have the ruling that Mr. Armstrong made. That, you know, that is not what the requirement is. The requirement is to the end that there should be no poor among you. That's the requirement. And those scriptures have all got to be put together to understand it. When we come into the inheritance and the jubilee, it also we can see this a similar thing applying over in Leviticus chapter 25. In Leviticus 25, again, here is a law reflecting God's financial perspective. It's a law that he has made that reflects it. Now, there is no way in today's society that we can apply this law. It just is not possible at all. The sabbatical year we can apply to a certain degree. And certainly within the church as well, if you do lend money to somebody, you should go ahead and cancel the debt. You should cancel the debt after the 7 years is up, or wherever the sabbatical year is, that your sabbatical year is. So we should keep that in mind even to this day. But in Leviticus 25, notice in verse 8, it says, and you will number 7 Sabbaths of years. Now, this is coming after the sabbatical year. So you've got 7 sabbatical years, which is 49 years, and to you 7 times 7 years, and the space of 7 Sabbaths of years shall be to you 49 years. Then you will cause the trumpet of the Jubilee to sound on the 10th day of the 7th month, on the Day of Atonement. Now that, I believe, is significant. I really do. Satan has trashed us. We are under a curse in this land, and in all the lands, quite frankly, on earth. Satan is still trashing us, and it is on that Day of Atonement when Satan will be bound for 1,000 years, that's the time when this release actually takes place. That you will make the trumpet sound throughout all of your land, and you will hallow the 50th year and proclaim liberty throughout all the land to all the inhabitants thereof. It will be a jubilee, something which is jubilant, an enormous joy. I mean, it's when these things occur in the world tomorrow, it is going to be a tremendous joy. And you will return every man to his possession, and you will return every man to his family. So it actually goes back to the possession. And if you go and read about, was it Ahithophel, was it? The daughters of Ahithophel, was it? Something like that. I'll have to go and actually look it up. But they said, look, we need an inheritance among the people, because they, therefore, otherwise the land would go away from the actual tribe. If it went to another tribe, he says, no, where there's no male heir, therefore it should go to the daughters, so that the land all around is of a particular tribe. And we're going to see that within the future. And in this, it's interesting when you look at the world, actually you can see a 50-year cycle within the economics of the world. And we are overdue by about 19 years now for a major depression followed by war. That's basically what's happened. And it's happened several times. It's not just the Second World War, First World War. It goes right back into the wars with France and all the rest of them. And it's a rough figure. You're going every 50 years that this occurs. And this, I think it was around about the time that Mr. Armstrong died that this should have come, and it didn't. And it's now another 20-odd years on. So this is just off the top of my head, but we're overdue for something along those lines. But I want you to notice the thinking behind the Jubilee. Notice in verse 23, it says, "The land shall not be sold forever, for the land is mine." It's God's land, it's not ours. The land that we till, the land that we own, it's not our land. We've got it, we're borrowing it for our lifetime. And that's all it is. That was the overall perspective. And that's the perspective that's being reflected in this law. You see, you have the perspective, the mind of God, and then you have a law that reflects that mindset. That's what it's all about. That's what this entire subject is all about. And again, Mr. Armstrong said in areas where it wasn't clear for the modern world, he tried to reflect the mindset and made rulings accordingly. The land shall not be sold forever, for the land is mine, and for you are strangers and sojourners with me. And every one of us in this room is. We're here for a little while. Interesting, if you also verse 17 notice, it says, "You shall not therefore oppress one another, but you will fear your God, for I am the eternal your God." Again, it's a case of how you actually sell land, and how you don't sell, you actually rent it to people for the number of years between then and the Jubilee. And that's how it's the actual crops that were able to be grown on that particular piece of land. The repercussions of this are huge. There are no big corporations. You can't have a McDonald's as we've got today. And let me show you something else as well. Notice in verse 31 here, it says, in verse 29, it says, "If a man sell a dwelling house in a walled city, then he may redeem it within a whole year after it's sold. Within a full year, he may redeem it, and if he doesn't, then it goes to that person forever." That's a walled city. But in verse 31, "But the houses of the villages that have no wall around about them shall be counted as the fields of the country. They may be redeemed, and they shall go out in the Jubilee." In other words, when the Jubilee comes along, it'll go back to the families. Now that's in the villages. What does it say about the world tomorrow? It talks about Tubal and Meshech going into a land of unwalled villages. We're looking at this law applying right across the board. There'll be very few cities there will be some cities, but the law seems to be applied across the board. In a land of unwanted, if you want to put it down in your notes, Ezekiel 38 verse 11, where it talks about that. But it describes the land of Israel as a land of unwalled villages in the world tomorrow. And as I say, we can't apply that law now, but we can at least see God's financial perspective. We can see the mind of God within it, and how, in fact, as it says here, the land's not to be sold forever. Now let's go on to the fourth point then, God's work and tithing. Turn over to Malachi chapter 3. Malachi chapter 3. In Malachi chapter 3, in verse 1 it says, "Behold, I will send my messenger, and he will prepare the way before me, and the Lord who you seek shall suddenly come to his temple, even the messenger of the covenant that you delight in. Behold, he shall come, says the Eternal of hosts. But who may abide, who is going to be sustained in the day of his coming, and who will stand when he appears?" You know, pray always that may be accounted worthy to escape these things and to stand, as it says. But here it says, "I am the Eternal, I change not, therefore you sons of Jacob are not consumed." So we're looking at, again, the same mind of God being applied, but the context, I want you to notice, is an end-time context. It's an end-time, this is an end-time event in chapters 1 and 2, and you go down to verse 18, "Then you'll return, discern between the righteous and the wicked, between him that serves God and him that serves him not. For behold, the days comes that shall burn as an oven, and the proud and all the wickedly will be stubble." And it says, "And you will tread down the wicked, for there will be ashes under your soles of your feet," verse 3. And then it goes into, "Behold, I'll send Elijah the prophet before the coming of the great and dreadful day of the Eternal." This is an end time setting. This whole section, I'm just hitting the high spots there, but the whole section here is an end time setting. You can tie it in with Matthew 17:11. I mean, I've gone over this section, believe me, on the apostleship booklet until I'm just about blue in the face. But really, this is a crucial piece of future prophecy, an end time prophecy. And yet in this section, verse 8, it says, "Will a man rob God? And yet you have robbed me. But you say, wherein have we robbed you? In tithes and offerings. You are cursed with a curse, for you have robbed me, even the whole nation. Bring all the tithes into the storehouse, that there may be food in my house." And it's talking about spiritual food as well. "In my house, and test me now herewith, says the Eternal of hosts, if I will not open to you the windows of heaven and pour out a blessing that there will not be room enough to receive it. And I rebuke the devourer." This was brought out in the sermonette. You know, it doesn't make sense. Tithing does not make sense. But it does work. It does actually work. It is a law. It is clearly a law that is brought out here, and it's brought out in an end-time setting. I know I myself had a certain view towards tithing. When I was self-employed, I could always work the amount of stock I would buy, the amount of expenditure that I would have or whatever. And I looked at tithing really as another form of taxation for years and years. I looked at it that way, and I changed my view. I suddenly started to realize, hang on a minute, it's not taxation at all, it's totally different. And I tried to get a more godly perspective of that, and my earnings doubled, literally, within a year. In fact, they weren't more than doubled. It doubled, and then it doubled again. It doubled literally. It was that type of change, and it was my attitude that had to change. And again, you're coming into the administration, the area of administration. Is it on gross? Is it on net? In America, they can actually make claim. They can claim the money back that they pay in tax on the tithe. So obviously they're able to pay the tithe and then claim the money back. It doesn't work the same way over here. There are also other things that involved, and there are certain cases where Mr. Armstrong made certain rulings. I remember, he's dead now, I don't see any reason why I shouldn't mention his name, Mr. Diedrich Zernikoff. He had an engineering business, and he was in Norway. And he was paying 90-something percent in tax. I mean, for a horrendous amount of money in tax, because they tax so heavily. If he had paid his tithes, he would have been paying 100-and-something percent of his income. Would go out. He would actually go down. His savings and everything would just disappear down a tube. It was impossible. It was totally impossible to pay gross in that situation. And Mr. Armstrong made the ruling for areas like that, which have a very high rate of taxation, where net is applied. And that was done by Mr. Armstrong. It was not done by Mr. Lukacs. I remember it specifically. But if you turn over to Leviticus 27, now that's the administration of it. Whatever you bind will be bound, whatever you loose will be loosed. But there are certain principles that we've got to understand about the tithe, and that is Leviticus 27. I know this is the administration, which was the Mosaic administration, but the principle here, it applies right across the board, from Melchizedek's the tithing to Melchizedek, all the way through into the change that was in Hebrews, which we'll just have a look at shortly. And this is the principle, Leviticus 27, verse 30. And all the tithe of the land, whether the seed of the land or the fruit of the tree, is the Eternal's. Okay? That is the principle. All the tithe is the Eternal's. It is holy to the Eternal. And if a man will at all redeem any of his tithes, he will add thereto a fifth part thereof. And concerning the tithe of the herd or the flock, even of whatever passes under the rod, the tenth shall be holy to the Eternal. And it was given to the Eternal, and the Eternal then gave it to the priests. In this administration, it was given to the Levites, I beg your pardon. It was given to the Levites under this administration, and the Levites then tithe to the priests. And this was the administration under the Mosaic covenant. But I wanted you to notice that the actual tithe itself, it says the tithe is God's. And it's the same kind of thing as when you look at the subject of the holy days. It says, even these are the feasts of the Eternal. It is God's feasts. It is God's tithe. The same basic principle. We found it, if you go over to Matthew chapter 23, we find here that in Matthew 23, here is Christ's perspective on the subject in dealing with the Pharisees and the Pharisees and scribes. It says, "Woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites! For you pay tithe of mint and anise and cumin, and have omitted the weightier matters of the law, judgment, mercy, and faith. These ought you to have done, and not to leave the others undone." So both are to be done. And it's quite clear that Christ put that into effect and gave us that example. If we go on a little bit, let's have a look. If you just want to put in your notes, Genesis 14, verse 17 to 20, that's Genesis 14, verse 17 to 20, you'll find that Abraham tithed to Melchizedek. So that was the one example of tithing. Genesis 28, verse 22, Jacob also tithed. That's Genesis 28, 22. So this is long before the Mosaic covenant. And Genesis 26, verse 5 of Genesis 26, Abraham kept my laws, so that these laws were understood at that time. But the administration was different. The administration was to Melchizedek. There was no Melchizedek administration. It then became the Mosaic Levitical administration. And then it went back to the Melchizedek administration again in the book of Hebrews, which we'll see. So if you go over to Numbers 18, remember we just read in Numbers 18, we've just read that all the tithe is the Eternal's. That's over in Leviticus 27. We just read that scripture. But in Numbers 18, notice in verse 20, it says, "The Eternal spoke to Aaron, You shall have no inheritance in the land, neither shall you have any part among them. I am your part and your inheritance among the children of Israel. So when the land was divided out, Levi didn't have an inheritance of the land. It had the cities, certain cities, but it didn't have an inheritance of the land. And behold, I have given the children of Levi all, notice what it says, all the tenth in Israel for an inheritance for their service which they serve, even the service of the tabernacle of the congregation. And make a note of that in your mind, that it is all the tithe. The tithe, the whole lot, went to Levi. Because this is important, because we'll come on to second tithe and third tithe, and people say, oh, there's just one tithe. But that very clearly says that all the tithe goes to Levi. You then come to other scriptures that will show that, hang on a minute, you do not give this to Levi, this is a separate tithe. And then you do not go ahead and keep this for the feast, this is another tithe. So it's very clear, three. And there's also, there's a reference which I'll read from Tobit, which is another apocryphal work, which gives that indication. Now, obviously, I don't give a great deal it's not canonized, but it is a historical book, which we can look at. So, all the tenth goes to Levi. Now, if you turn over to Hebrews chapter 1, we see here, because what we need to, the only question that we really need to ask is, to whom do we tithe? To whom do we tithe? That is our responsibility. It's not a case of how much we tithe. It is not a case of whether we tithe. It is a case of to whom. And that is the responsibility of every single one of us in this room. We've got to determine that ourselves. And we've got to make sure that we determine it properly. But in Hebrews chapter 1, it says, God, who at different times and in different ways spoke in times past to the fathers by the prophets, has in these last days spoken to us by a Son, who he has appointed the heir of all things, by whom also he made the worlds. And this Son, it goes in verse 13, it says, but to which of the angels did he say at any time, sit on my right hand until I make your enemies your footstool? Now that's Psalm 110 verse 1. And it goes on and it talks about being made a priest forever after the order of Melchizedek in that particular passage. Now Paul, who is almost certainly the writer of Hebrews, over in chapter 7, develops this subject. And in chapter 7, notice he says, verse 11, it says, if therefore perfection were by the Levitical priesthood, for under it the people received the law, what further need was there that another priest should arise after the order of Melchizedek? Now he's just been talking in preceding verses about Melchizedek. And not be called after the order of Aaron. Because when we're looking at Aaron, and he also has been talking about actually paying tithes to Melchizedek. And it says, for the priesthood being changed, there is made of necessity a change also of the law. Now the law that is changed is the administration. It is to whom we tithe. That is the change. The change is to whom we tithe. Notice the subject matter, verse 9, as I may say, so say, Levi, who also paid tithes in Abraham. The subject matter of this section, you'll have to look at it in your own time, but the subject matter is tithing. And it is to do with a change in the law as who you actually tithe to. Now, if we go on a little bit more, and as I say, this is almost a sermon in itself or a Bible study in itself. But if you go over to chapter 10, notice verse 8. He's talking from Psalm 40, verse 6 to 8. And it says above, when he says, sacrifices and offerings and burnt offerings for sin you would not, neither had pleasure therein, which are offered by the law, then he said, lo, I come to do your will, O God. He takes away the first, that's the offerings, which were offered by the Levitical priesthood, that he may establish the second, which is to do your will, O God, that's the second, by the which will we are sanctified through the offering of the body of Jesus Christ once for all. So it's looking at a Melchizedek priesthood. So this again, you're looking at here, to do your will, O God, is the definition, is where you will find where that priesthood is actually being applied, where the people are being subject to the high priest, which is the one after the order of Melchizedek. And if we go on a little bit further into Hebrews 13, in verse 7, he caps this entire section off, entire book off. He says, "Remember those that have the rule over you, who have spoken to you the word of God, whose example or conduct or faith follow, considering the end of their conduct. Jesus Christ is the same yesterday, today, and forever." We just saw that back in Malachi. "Do not be carried around with different and strange doctrines or teachings, for it's good that the heart be established with grace and not with rules of diet," as Philip says, or meats, "which have not profited those that have been occupied therein. But we have an altar of which they have no right to eat, which serve the tabernacle." So there was a change in the law. It was a change from the Levitical priesthood across to the Melchizedek priesthood, and it is to do with doing your will, O God, which is the defining thing. So what we have got to do as people of God is we have got to see within this, you know, our responsibility in the tithing is to have a look and be very sure that who we tithe to is doing the will of God. It is the will of God that is important. And that is the definition. That is the defining area. And that is, it's not a case of whether we tithe or how much we tithe. Tithing is 10%, but it's not that. That is not what we're looking for. But who we tithe to, that is important. And every single last one of us that tithes has got to determine that. That is important. Now we've seen, if we go into second tithe and then rapidly into third tithe and then try and round it off. But in second tithe, we've just seen where in Numbers 18:21 it talks about how all the tithe is to be paid to Levi. All the tithe is to be paid to Levi. If you turn over to Deuteronomy 14, you find in Deuteronomy 14, verse 22, that here is a tithe that is not paid to Levi. And it says, "You shall truly tithe all the increase of your seed that the field brings forth year by year, and you will eat before the Eternal your God in the place that he chooses to place his name there, there the tithe of your corn, of your wine, and your oil, and the firstlings of your herds." So here were tithes that were not part of that grouping, that were given to Levi. If the way is too long for you, you turn it into money, and you go to wherever God has chosen to place his name. Now the place, if you go on a little bit, let's have a look. Well, let's go back to Deuteronomy chapter 12. We find here that in verse 5, says, "But unto the place which the Eternal your God will choose out of all your tribes to put his name there, even to his habitation shall you seek, and there shall you come, and there you will bring your burnt offerings and your sacrifices and your tithes and heave offerings of your hand and your vows and your freewill offerings, firstlings of your herds and your flocks, and there you will eat before the Eternal your God, and you will rejoice in all that you have put your hand to and your household in which the Eternal your God has blessed you." And we're looking here in verse 8, it says, "And you shall not do after all the things that we do here this day, every man whatever is right in his own eyes." So in this, it is pretty specific as to what is actually being laid down. If you turn and look at verse 17, it says, "You may not eat within your gates the tithe of your corn or your wine or your oil or the firstlings of your herds or your flocks, of any of your vows which you vow or your freewill offerings, but you must eat them before the Eternal your God in the place which the Eternal your God shall choose, you, your son, your daughter." It's very clear that this is a different tithe. It is a separate tithe. The second tithe is separate. Now there is some confusion out there. If you go out into the great unwashed churches of God, in the various on the internet, you will find people trying to argue that no, it's all one tithe, or you know, you can give a different percentage or whatever. No, sorry, it isn't. It's quite clear. And it, besides that, you go back to the apostle, and you find that it is quite clear, and it's clearly been given to us, you know, how we tithe and what, in fact, we how this actually fits together. And he's gone back again, as we'll go on. We'll read a little bit from Tobit, or I'll read a little bit to you from Tobit. That sets that down. So we see how, in fact, also, if you turn over to chapter 14 again, you notice in verse 26, when you've got this money, which is your second tithe, it says, and you will bestow that money for whatever your soul lusts after, for oxen, in other words, beef steaks, or for sheep, for lamb chops, or for wine, or strong drink, or whatever your soul desires, and you will eat there before the Eternal your God, and you will rejoice, you and your household. Now, people have used that to say, right, if you can eat it, then it's fine to spend it on. If you can't eat it, then it isn't. You remember sermons like that years ago? The people used to get up, a particular individual used to get up there and say that. In general, that is true. In general, that is true. That if it is to be used at the feast, then that's what the second tithe is for. But again, you're looking at what is God's financial perspective. And you've got to look at that perspective, and you've got to put the subject into that perspective. And we see how Mr. Armstrong implemented several things. For instance, it talks in Matthew 23:23, don't forget judgment, mercy, and faith. You know, we don't use second tithe just purely for ourselves. If we see somebody having need, we have surplus second tithe, and we give that second tithe to them. That is an application of the basic principles. If we need a dress, say, and we don't, not we, not we, I look very funny in a dress, but if a lady needs a dress and hasn't got something suitable for services at the feast, Mr. Armstrong made very clear that it's perfectly permissible to go out and buy the dress and to use it for the feast. Now, it doesn't mean to say you buy one of these £3,000 whatevers, you know. That is not going according to God's principles. It's you know, it's trying to go around the law. It's trying to get, you know, bits of fig shoved into your coat pocket so you walk a Sabbath day journey, drop a piece of your property and walk another bit. That's not the way we keep the law. That's not the way we approach things. But if we need to do that, that isn't a problem. But going out and buying a great hi-fi set and thinking, oh, I'm going to listen to it at the feast. You know, it's cost you all your second tithe, and then you take it home and you stick it in your room. That's going, you know, you're getting your figs out and dropping them and so on. Because you've gone ahead and listened to it at the feast, that's what you're going to do. You know, look at it. It is God's financial perspective. What is God's perspective of it? How do we actually apply it? You know, Mr. Armstrong did make rulings in this area. Also, I mean, when you've got a shut-in, I mean, somebody who cannot get to this feast, either from ill health or for the distance involved, and we're looking today particularly this is a problem because we've got a site in Overhaddon and we've got a site over in Tucson. What about West Africa? I mean, it's not a site as such. As far as I'm concerned, they are part of Overhaddon. It's a bit of a distance, but they hopefully will be logged into Overhaddon. This is why I'm determined if we can, we'll get them logged in there. And if not, then we'll be able to go ahead and post some sermons down to them. We actually done it yet? It's gone. Certain of them have already gone. We also have a possible site over on the east coast of the U.S. where people might not be able to get across to the west coast because it's almost as expensive to fly to the west coast as it is to fly across here. And again, if that is the case, again, you look at God's financial perspective, the way in which Mr. Armstrong actually dealt with this. And the shut-ins, they were sent tapes and they kept the feast in their own home, in that sense, being part of a feast site, but albeit remotely, because they couldn't get to a feast site. You know, God's law is not to go ahead and screw somebody into the ground. It is a giving, outgoing law that is so important. Right, rapidly on to the third tithe. Again, Deuteronomy 14, verse 28, it says, at the end of 3 years you will bring forth all the tithe of your increase the same year, and you will lay it up within your gates. And the Levite, because he's got no part or inheritance with you, and the stranger and the fatherless and the widow which are within your gates, will come and eat and be satisfied, that the Eternal your God may bless you in all the work that your hand that you do. Again, second tithe is not to be eaten within the gates, we've just seen that. First tithe is to all be given to the Levites, we've seen that. So here is a third tithe. And it is something that is implemented. And it's also interesting that if you notice the way this works, this third tithe, it flows into chapter 15, that at the end of 7 years you make a release. So you have 3 years, there's your third tithe. Another 3 years, there's your third tithe. Then you have the year of release, and you start again. 3 years, there's your third tithe. Another 3 years, there's your third tithe. Then the year of release. It's three and six in a seven-year cycle, and it's the way in which the verses run into each, from chapter 14 runs into chapter 15. But it's not designed to make us poor. This ruling is not designed to make us poor. It is also important that it's not actually designed for the poor, incidentally. It's designed, notice in verse 29, it says, the fatherless, the stranger, the fatherless, the widow, which is within your gates, will come and eat and be satisfied. In other words, it's people that don't have an inheritance in the land. That is the application. The primary application of third tithe is the widow and the fatherless. I know that in the years gone by, because it also talks about the Levite here, it was also used by the ministry to pay ministerial salaries to a large degree in the United States. And it was actually used as a means of clearing down the third tithe account. That was actually how it was used. And obviously for third tithe assistance as well. But this was done so that it freed more money up for the work. That was applying this verse. Now, that's not something that happens here. But it is not designed to make us poor. Mr. Armstrong saw the government of this country, and also in Scandinavia, and how they provided for the social security and the social services that were so different from the United States at the time, and he made the ruling that it wasn't to be applied in the same way over here. And there were certain rules that he made. He said, look, those that can certainly do, but it's not a necessity in the sense that we should go out and make ourselves in receipt of third tithe. We should never make ourselves in receipt of third tithe by keeping a third tithe year. That is not, it doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense. And that is a ruling, again, that came from Mr. Armstrong. Another thing that maybe some of you don't realize is that if you have a close relative who needs assistance, you should help them with your third tithe. I don't know whether you realize that, but that is also another ruling that Mr. Armstrong did make. He also made the ruling that in such a circumstance you find that you need to sustain, support them over a period of time, it is permissible to actually, instead of tithing every third and sixth year in a seven-year cycle, you pay, 2.86% or whatever else it is, every year, and you then support that relative. Again, you should go towards third and sixth year in a seven-year cycle, but the principle, and it is God's financial perspective, has got to be kept in mind as well. It is not applied in a rigorous Levitical way. It is applied in a new covenant. I hesitate to even use that word, but that is the way, in fact, which Mr. Armstrong actually used that, applied it. Okay, just a couple of points. And if Tobit, I said I'd read something from Tobit. This is Tobit 1, verse 6. Now, this is not a book of the Bible. It is not canonized. If you find out what it's all about, Tobit was actually, he had some kind of a son that went off and had a fish or something. He found some I don't know, some real weird thing, you're going blind and all some real weird stuff. But in this kind of traditional book of Judaism, it says in verse 6, he says, "But I alone went often to Jerusalem at the feasts, as it was ordained to all the people of Israel by an everlasting decree, having the first fruits and tenths of increase." And he goes on in verse 7, it says, "The first tenth part of all increase I gave to the sons of Aaron, who ministered at Jerusalem. Another tenth part I sold away, and I went and spent it every year at Jerusalem. And the third part I gave to them to whom it was fitting, as Deborah my father's mother had commanded me, because I was left an orphan by my father." So it's very clear from that passage that there were three tithes that the Jews were recognizing around that time. I read that for what it's worth. I don't recommend the Book of Tobit. Quite frankly, it's a load of rubbish. Most of it really is. But nevertheless, it does seem to indicate that that's the way they were looking at it. So God's perspective, as with all his perspectives, is an outgoing one. If you notice in Deuteronomy 26, a couple of scriptures just to close. In verse 12, here there's a declaration made which was made at that time. It says, "When you have made an end of tithing all the tithes of your increase the third year, which is the year of tithing, and has given it to the Levites, the stranger, the fatherless, the widow, and they may eat it within the gates and be filled, then you will say before the Eternal your God, I have brought away your hallowed things out of my house, I have given them to the Levites, the stranger, the fatherless, and the widow, according to all your commandments which you have commanded me. I have not transgressed your commandments. I have not eaten thereof in my mourning," or the word is the Hebrew word avan, which literally means my trouble, my difficulties. In other words, I haven't dipped into them myself. "Neither have I taken away anything for any unclean use or given anything to the dead, but I've listened to the voice of the Eternal my God and have done according to all that you've commanded me." So here we see this declaration that was made in the third year by the Israelites of old. And it says in verse 15, "Look down from your holy habitation from heaven and bless your people Israel and the land which you have given us, as you swore to our fathers, a land that flows with milk and honey." But God does, he owns all. He wants his mind in us. He's given us the natural world to teach us many things about that mind. And if we turn over to Malachi 3 again, just closing, we'll just read Malachi 3. Realize just why it is so important that we understand this subject. It's an end time setting. But in Malachi chapter 3, we need to tell the difference between Satan's world in which we live and God's perspective in the financial areas, which is so radically different. In Malachi chapter 3, notice in verse 16, it says, "Those that feared the Eternal spoke often one to another, and the Eternal listened and heard, and a book of remembrance was written before him for those that feared the Eternal and thought on his name." And remember, in that context, you've got verse 8, 9, and 10 for about tithing. "And they shall be mine, says the Eternal of hosts, in the day when I make my jewels. And I will spare them as a man spares his own son that serves him." And he's sparing the people like this for a reason. "Then you shall return, and you'll discern between the righteous and the wicked, between him that serves God and him that serves him not." We've got to be able to discern this. We ourselves have got to look at this world, which is a satanic world and a satanic system. We've also got to look at God's financial perspective, and we've got to be able to tell the difference clearly, very, very clearly. We've got to be able to see very clearly the difference between the two systems. And we do need to use our time now in this life to think, to learn, to repent where necessary, so that we can actually be teachers and make that discernment in the future, in the very world tomorrow.